and welcome to APAC Weekly, where we bring you a showcase of our conversations on the APAC Network. I'm Auriel Morrison. Coming up this week:
insights revealed into the speed of climate change, defining leadership in the 21st century, why the global whale population is suffering from environmental impacts.
According to the latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the damage being inflicted on our environment is more significant, more rapid, and worse than previously estimated. However, researchers from the Australian National University are optimistic that we have the tools and knowledge to tackle the crisis head on. One of the report's authors, Professor Mark Howden, joins us now to explain the findings and talk us through what action we can take to mitigate the effects of climate change. Professor Howden, so how does the new report compare to previous estimates of the impacts of climate change?
I think the overall takeaway is that we've been underestimating impacts. When we look at the new literature and evidence, it seems that for any given temperature increase, we see worse impacts than previously estimated, and our adaptation effectiveness is less than previously assessed. So by and large, things are looking worse, and also in terms of emissions, our emissions continue to increase. They're at record levels, and we've got record levels of greenhouse gas concentrations and record levels of temperature increase as well. So by and large, it's actually a story which is more challenging, but at the same time, we have explored more options to deal with the challenges we have ahead of us.
So one of the things that your report highlighted was the timeline for reaching that 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming. What was your report's findings on that kind of timescale that we've got?
Yeah, so essentially we're likely to meet 1.5 or exceed 1.5 degrees by the 2030s, and that's under all different greenhouse gas emission scenarios. Under a low emission scenario, or very low emission scenario, we may temporarily exceed 1.5 degrees and then come back down. That's what we call an overshoot scenario. But at the moment, we're heading well above any of those overshoot scenarios. At the moment, we're heading for 3.2 degrees increase above pre-industrial levels. And that's a huge increase in global temperatures.
So obviously something needs to be done quite urgently. So what immediate action does the IPCC recommend based on your report's findings?
Well, the IPCC doesn't make recommendations, but it does lay out the evidence. And the evidence is that we have a huge number of emission reduction options which are viable to implement. So things which we know how to implement, we can implement it relatively cost-effectively, and they are often compatible with our existing systems. So, for example, just think renewable energy. And so, roughly speaking, we have in the kit bag around about half of our emission reductions could be implemented by things that we already know about, which are relatively low cost. They're either negative cost, we make a profit, or they're relatively low cost. And so the problem is, of course, we're not implementing those emission reduction options quick enough. And similarly, we have lots and lots of adaptation options, which we know how to implement. We know something about their effectiveness. But again, we're not implementing those fast enough.
And what are the barriers in place at the moment to those implementing them a lot faster?
Oh, there's lots and lots. The way things have been done around here type sort of mentalities, risk aversion, referencing to uncertainty, financial barriers, institutional barriers, social psychological barriers. There's a whole stack of them. And often people are much more interested in finding reasons why not to do things rather than exploring the options to do things and the benefits from doing things differently.
So it all does sound still quite alarming. Where are you finding the positivity after looking at the results of this report?
Well, we are making inroads in terms of emission reduction. So our emissions, while they're still going up, and we're getting record levels of emissions year after year at the moment, but they're not going up as quickly as they used to. And so they are starting to level off. We are starting to see massive rollouts of renewable electricity generation right across the globe. Its price has come down, the price of electricity storage has come down, and there's new technologies being explored almost every day, things like, you know, low emissions aviation solutions, similar things. We're seeing new battery technologies and new ways of organising our electricity grid, and those sorts of things are happening, you know, day by day and week by week. And so there's hope coming from those things. And there's also hope that we're actually generating the momentum in the public and also in governments to take climate change much more seriously. And this is transferring into the industry sector where companies, at least some companies, are starting to take climate change seriously. And those that don't take it seriously are getting pushed by investors and insurers and regulators as well.
So what more needs to be done to kind of push the policymakers, business leaders and members of the public in the right direction when it comes to that urgency about climate change?
I think a lot of it comes down to just saying that we expect more and we expect better. When we look at the Australians' attitudes on climate change, the overwhelming majority of Australians want more action on climate change. So the Lowy Institute poll for many years now has shown that 90% of Australians want more action on climate change. And so that's a pretty overwhelming number. What I would like to see is governments and business responding to that overwhelming sentiment and giving people options for low emissions activity, low emissions services and goods, which actually can be at a good price point. And so people will adopt them. They'll feel better off for doing that. There's new market opportunities. The businesses are better off and the planet's better off as well. And of course, future generations are going to be better off as well.
And in the meantime, what can individuals do to kind of help?
Well, firstly, I think we want to get informed, about the bigger picture of climate change. The IPCC reports are a great source of that. They're the most robust reports on the topic and they're easily accessible. Just a click on the web can deliver those to you. Secondly, I think informed about our own footprint. So do a greenhouse gas calculation for yourself or for your family and find out where those sources of greenhouse gases are coming from and what you can do sensibly to reduce those. And then I think, as I mentioned before, push up into systems, push up into the governmental system, tell our elected representatives that we want something more done on climate change. Yes, for example, the electric vehicle strategy is good, but is it going fast enough and far enough? For example, people have said we should have targets for electric vehicles. So push into the system, say we expect more, and start to, I think, talk with others, particularly those who aren't engaged in climate change or who are sceptical, and actually generate conversations which are respectful and which demonstrate the changes that we're seeing. With, you know, the changes that we're seeing are now unequivocal. They are not debatable from a science point of view. The thing that is debatable is what do we do about it? You know, do we put on a price on carbon or do we to use some other regulatory mechanism? Do we rely on technology to deliver the goods? Those are all legitimate debates to have. But let's stop arguing about the climate science and let's move on to the solutions.
It's well known by now the global transition from fossil fuels to renewables is critical to meeting the world's emissions reduction targets set out in the UN's Sustainable Development Goals and the Paris Agreement. But these fuels, including coal, oil and natural gas, still remain our dominant sources of power, supplying around 80% of the world's energy needs. Every year, the World Energy Council releases its Trilemma Index, so named because of the energy trilemma which countries have to manage. Energy security, energy equity, and the environmental sustainability of energy systems. In its most recent edition, Sweden took the top spot, closely followed by Switzerland and Denmark. In fact, the top 10 spots were dominated by OECD countries, particularly in Europe. To explore this further, we're joined now by Dr. Angela Wilkinson, Secretary General of the World Energy Council. Now, Angela, what essentially is the purpose of the Trilemma Index? Do you hope to bring attention to those not doing enough?
Well, we introduced the World Energy Trilemma Index framework nearly 20 years ago, and we use it to help countries track, assess, and design their policies for moving forward. And the index has a global comparative ranking of 120 countries. So countries can look and see how they compare with others. But more importantly, it also provides them with their national year-on-year improvement measures. And we can also look at who are the top performing countries, the most improved, and who are the least improved countries, and what can we learn about the policies that they are making and changing. So it's designed to be a tool to support governments and their stakeholders in thinking about how they manage the trilemma through transition.
So when you look at the fact that this index actually tracks national policy performance over time and measures progress against other nations, who stands out as a top performer over time?
Well, over the last 20 years, of course, the European countries have tended to come top in the World Energy Trilemma Index in terms of the comparative rankings. And that's because they've had a longer standing approach to incorporating environmental and sustainability policies alongside affordability, equity, and security policies. But of course, what we've seen in the last 6 months is a European energy crisis, which is cascading across the world. So we know that we have to rethink the security aspects of the World Energy Trilemma Index and transition management. This security crisis is very different to the oil shock of the 1970s, which was very much about constraints of supply. This is actually a demand-driven energy crisis shock because it's countries deciding to decouple themselves from supplies in other parts of the world that have contributed to these high prices and cost of living crisis. So energy security is no longer about supply side diversification. We now have to think about demand disruption and demand destruction in energy security.
You have often said that when it comes to the energy landscape overall, what we see today is crowded, you've called it competitive and costly. And we need to see more sustainable energy. Are we moving fast enough when it comes to this transition?
Well, the World Energy Pulse shows that most countries think this current global energy shock will accelerate energy transitions in all regions. But I think the important bit to remember is that there are multiple energy transition pathways. There's no one size fits all. Each of these pathways will have a greater mix of resources and technologies and will also use other measures such as carbon capture and storage and nature-based solutions in order to achieve their net zero goals. And the other bit that we have to bear in mind, when you opened, Aurélie, you talked about 20% of the global energy system is currently electrified. And only 15% of that 20% is renewable electrification. So as we take renewables to scale, we are finding new security issues around materials, metals, and water in terms of taking renewable energy resources to scale.
Is this part of your concerns, which you vocalised before, about the lack of energy literacy across stakeholder groups?
Absolutely. So energy literacy, like financial literacy, is going to come to the fore. If we really want to address the scope 3 emissions of the Paris Agreement, that's the emissions you and I are responsible for in our use of energy, directly and indirectly, then there's no way to do that without thinking about what we mean by useful energy and users, and affordability, as well as security and climate change. And affordability isn't just about willingness to pay or ability to pay. It's also value in use. And our uses of energy are changing, and our needs and how we're storing energy is changing. And the costs of supplying energy are not being fully priced in to some of these comparisons around different energy options.
Now, if we look at some of the latest results that's come out of the Trilemma Index, they show that renewables account for over 80% of new capacity additions. But global carbon dioxide emissions still continue to rise. What is the solution here?
Well, our solution is humanising energy. That is, you've got to involve users and uses, not just think about suppliers and producers. There's most of the attention around investment at the moment is about investing in new supplies that are clean and green. But actually, we can't address the Paris Agreement or the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals without thinking about the people side of energy. Who are the users? What are their behaviours? What's their understanding of role in energy transition, and how do we enable and empower them to play their part? So I think the answer is humanizing energy rather than keeping this conversation around the supply-centric mindset that we think dominates policy and discourse at the moment.
Now, when you look at the geographic picture, Angela, of course, you're coming to us from London today. We know that Europe is doing fairly well when it comes to the transition. How does this region, how does the Asia-Pacific region stack up?
So, well, the World Energy Council operates in over 94 countries across the world. So, you know, I'm here in London, but our members are distributed across the entire world and all regions. And there are big differences. There are big differences in narrative as well around what's the story of getting to net zero. So in Europe, we tend to talk about clean and just energy transitions. In North America, they tend to talk about resilient and sustainable energy transitions. In the Middle East, they tend to talk about circular carbon economy transitions. And in the Asia region, I think there's five Asias actually in our membership. There's not one Asia. There's also a concept of ecological civilization, which I find fascinating because it's the only frame really that says this is about people and planet, whereas the others are really about technologies and investments.
Whale populations around the world are recovering after decades of over-exploitation by the whaling industry. But this thriving population is now facing the challenge of climate change and ocean warming. Researchers from Australia, South Africa and South America have joined forces to address this problem. And we're now joined by Dr. Olaf Meinecke, manager of the Whales and Climate Program and researcher from Griffith University. Doctor, thanks for joining us today. You've just returned from Antarctica, where you're looking to better understand the climate impacts on whale species. How was the trip?
It was a very exciting trip. It was also on board with a special guest, Dr. Sylvia Earle from the States. And we've been very lucky to head out there to explore some of that environment, of course. And for me, it was the first time. But in all that sort of, a wonderful environment, there's also, there's trouble in that place. And the humpback whales that we're particularly looking at, which are impacted by climate change as any other species on this planet, they're feeding in this area, and they're starting to change the way they're feeding, where they're feeding, and how often they actually migrate to that part of Antarctica. So we went to West Antarctic Peninsula, which is sort of like the top of the Antarctic region that is actually impacted by warming stronger or more than any other place in the Antarctic. And of course, the whales are responding to this with a change in their behavior.
Oh, how concerned are you about the change in behavior?
With humpback whales, they are quite intelligent and they are definitely capable of adapting to changes. And we're seeing that they're adapting around the world in different populations. These changes include seeking out new places for feeding. So we've got supergroups come up where a lot of whales feed outside the traditional feeding grounds. And they are also capable of actually social feed or single feed, depending on what food supply they have. And they can seek out food over thousands of kilometers if they have to. I am concerned about the fact that, you know, we've got more and more whales, in particular in the Northern Hemisphere, that are actually looking for food in places where they normally do not go. They are exposed to higher risk, vessel strikes, entanglement in fishing gear. So it's like a secondary impact that comes with that search for different food sources that is concerning, because the number of whales that are entangled, the number of whales that are involved in vessel strikes is actually increasing drastically over the last couple of years.
So the whales which travel along Australia's east coast and through the so-called Blue Corridor, they may soon not be able to get enough food for their long migration north.
So what are they doing is basically changing their migration timing. So they know that there is a shift in food availability in Antarctica, and that means that arriving earlier in some places is of benefit, and leaving earlier is also beneficial because there's no food to gain. So the problem is that, you know, they are obviously requiring to seek out new food sources if possible. So we've actually seen more sub-adults staying in the Australian waters. And that actually, of course, you know, creates other issues with entanglements, for instance. So while the humpback whale population is relatively stable at this point, we are sort of concerned that, you know, we might reach a point where, you know, there is a decline happening because the whales are not able to find enough food or not able to reproduce quickly enough. So far, humpback whales have been the success story of conservation in the marine world, and they are a great and a wonderful story to talk about when it comes to recovery of a baleen whale from whaling. But of course, they are now sort of on the front line of change because their numbers are high, there's a lot of them out there, and they all need food.
So research has shown that whales are already adapting by having their calves further south. Is that because that they don't have the energy to make it to their old breeding grounds?
So we think one of the adaptation is that they can have births in sort of like temperate or in subtropical waters. They do not need to migrate all the way up to the north where it's obviously warmer. So for instance, the Great Barrier Reef or Ningaloo Reef, they can actually have births along their way. And they've been doing this in the past, but we are really noticing that, you know, we've seen calving in New South Wales, so really in the sort of more temperate to subtropical waters. And of course, by doing this, they don't have to migrate as far. So they, you know, it's a few, if almost 2,000 or 3,000 kilometers that they do not have to swim, and they can save the energy and put it to the calf.
Okay, so what's next for you? What will you be looking into?
So we have gathered a lot of data from various researchers and organizations, and one of the big aims is to analyze this data for patterns. So it's over 150,000 sightings of humpback whales that we're going to look at. And the sort of aim is to find out what kind of long-term trends can we find in the data and how it relates to climate change.
Researchers are aiming to redefine leadership in the 21st century with the use of cybernetic principles. The Australian National University's School of Cybernetics hopes their latest report will help equip Australia's current and emerging leaders with the skills to shape the future of our fast, smart and interconnected world. Well, Professor Catherine Daniel is one of the report's authors and joins us now to talk about the role of cybernetics in leadership. Professor, welcome. Can you explain in simple terms what cybernetics is?
So cybernetics is a field of study and practice that looks at complex systems, how we act in them, and how we think about the interplay between technologies and environments and societies. It helps us really look at the interactions and the different facets of how we see the world and how we navigate through it.
So how can those principles help leaders, for example, the example that you use from your report, to kind of navigate the complex systems that we have in place in our world already?
In the report, we talk about a number of principles. One of those is perspective plurality. One of the challenges we have with developing many of our new systems in today's world, so there are only certain people and perspectives that are involved in building them. You think about many of the new technological products. They're often built in the Western world by a certain group of the population, and this means that there are many perspectives that aren't included. One of the things that the School of Cybernetics is trying to do, including in our cybernetic leadership work, is show that there are many other perspectives that are really important. Some of those include Indigenous perspectives. The Australian National University is based here in Ngunnawal and Ngambri country. And so we have many Indigenous perspectives that can really add a lot to leadership. We have people in this school and beyond who have been leading the development of technologies here.
So what are some of the potential challenges in applying those to leadership and social systems?
I think one of the challenges we've seen is many of our current systems are locked in. Many of our current government systems have a certain range of silos, and we've often found it quite difficult to work between those silos. A lot of cybernetic leadership is about boundary work. It's about figuring out pathways and bridges between those different silos, reorganising our systems to be able to develop action that is collective, not individual. And so people who have been, for example, taking our master's program and micro-learning, including around cybernetic leadership, are learning how to have those difficult conversations. A lot of what cybernetics is and has been right since the Second World War is about convening difficult conversations, conversations between a range of different people and perspectives where we may not agree on definitions. But we do see that there's value in those perspectives because they enable us to see parts of complex systems that we can't see ourselves. A bit like that idea about